Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today, we're tackling a tricky area that trips up many a law student, where a case can actually be heard the concept of jurisdiction.
Yeah, it can get confusing fast.
To make it stick, we're zeroing in on a really illustrative case. John S. Clark Covey, Travelers Indemnity Co. of Illinois.
Oh, that's a great one. This case perfectly highlights how things can get complicated when you have multiple parties and, you know, different claims all stemming from the same situation.
Right.
We've got a construction defect dispute at the center, an insurance company involved, and the subcontractor who did the work. The core question, whether this whole legal battle belongs in federal court or back in the state court where it was first filed.
And hopefully by the end of this, our listeners will have a much clearer understanding of the crucial principles at play.
Exactly. That's the goal.
Exactly. And as usual, we've got our hands full of useful stuff, some internal guidance to keep us on track, a detailed breakdown of the case itself, and even a standard legal brief to give us a different angle.
Okay.
Bro, let's unpack this, starting with the essential background.
Okay. So picture the scene. John S. Clark Company, a contractor, had an insurance policy with Travelers Indemnity Company of Illinois. This policy was intended to cover property damage that resulted from faulty work done by subcontractors.
Makes sense.
Now, Clark hired Herrera Masonry, Inc. for a construction project. Unfortunately, things went wrong. There were structural collapses and other defects that Clark believed were due to Herrera's poor workmanship.
Right. So Clark, facing the costs of fixing all this, did what makes sense.
Yeah.
They filed a lawsuit in a North Carolina state court.
Yep.
They sued Travelers, their insurance provider, to get coverage under the policy. And they also sued Herrera, the subcontractor, arguing that Herrera was responsible for the defects and should, you know, cover Clark's losses. Seems pretty straightforward on the surface, right?
It does seem that way initially, but here's where it gets really interesting jurisdictionally. Travelers decided they prefer to litigate this in federal court. Federal courts, under what's called diversity jurisdiction, essentially, when parties from different states are involved in a significant monetary dispute, designed in part to avoid potential state court bias, they can hear certain cases that would normally be in state court.
Right, the $75,000 amount in controversy plus diversity.
Exactly. So Travelers tried to move the entire case to federal court, arguing that the requirements for diversity jurisdiction were met.
But there was a catch, a pretty significant one involving the home states of the parties, wasn't there?
Precisely. A huge catch. For the purposes of jurisdiction, Clark, the contractor, was considered a citizen of North Carolina. And here's the key. Herrera, the subcontractor, was also a citizen of North Carolina.
Ooh, okay.
Now, for diversity jurisdiction to be valid under this specific federal law, 28 U.S.C. Section 1332, we need what's known as complete diversity. This is a strict rule. Every single plaintiff must be from a different state than every single defendant. No shared state citizenship is allowed. Ah, okay. So with both Clark and Herrera being from North Carolina, that complete diversity that Travelers needed just wasn't there. That must have thrown a wrench in their federal court plans.
Oh, absolutely. A major wrench. So Clark and Herrera then filed a motion to remand the case. Essentially, they were asking the federal court to send it back to the state court where it originated.
Arguing lack of jurisdiction.
Arguing that the federal court lacked the necessary jurisdiction to hear the case in the first place because of this lack of complete diversity.
Yeah, smart move. But Travelers wasn't about to give up on federal court that easily, were they? They had another procedural tactic they tried to employ.
They did. Travelers filed a motion to dismiss Herrera from the case altogether, using something called Federal Rule of Civil Procedure 21.
Rule 21, okay.
This rule gives the court the power to add or remove parties from a lawsuit. Travelers' strategy was clear. If they could get Herrera dismissed from the case, then you'd have Clark from, essentially, North Carolina suing Travelers from Illinois, and suddenly you'd have that complete diversity needed for federal jurisdiction.
Sneaky indeed. So the court was then faced with a bit of a procedural puzzle. What were the main legal questions they had to sort out?
There were two primary legal questions the court had to answer. First, was Herrera even properly included as a defendant in the original lawsuit filed in state court? This brings Federal Rule of Civil Procedure 20A.
Right, joinder.
Which deals with what's called permissive joinder, the rules about when multiple defendants can be sued together in the same action into the picture. Second, even if the court found that Herrera was properly joined initially, but their presence destroyed the required diversity of citizenship, should the court then use its discretion under Rule 21 to simply drop Herrera from the case to allow the case against Travelers to proceed in federal court?
Okay, let's dive into that first question about whether Herrera was properly joined under Rule 20A. What are the key requirements for that rule to be satisfied? Well, Rule 20A lays out a couple of key conditions that need to be met for joining multiple defendants in a single lawsuit. First, the claims asserted against them must arise out of the same transaction, occurrence, or series of transactions or occurrences.
Okay, same transaction or occurrence.
Think of transaction or occurrence. Broadly, it's the factual situation that gives rise to the lawsuit. Second, there must be questions of law or fact that are common to all the claims being asserted against these defendants.
Got it. Same transaction and common questions. And how did the court in the Clark case analyze whether the claims against Travelers and Herrera met these requirements for permissive joinder?
The court concluded without much hesitation that they absolutely did meet the requirements of Rule 20A. When you look at it, both of Clark's claims, the one against Travelers for insurance coverage and the one against Herrera for the defective construction work and, you know, resulting indemnification, both originated from the exact same central event.
The collapse.
The structural collapse of the construction project, which Clark alleged was a direct result of Herrera's faulty masonry work.
Yeah. So the shared factual route, the collapse and its alleged cause, is the key link connecting these two different claims against two different parties.
Precisely. The court really focused on that same transaction or occurrence element. And it's important for law students to remember that courts tend to interpret this quite broadly.
Right. It's not narrow.
No, it's not limited to just the contract between Clark and Herrera, but encompasses the entire sequence of events. The alleged poor workmanship, the subsequent collapse, the repairs that Clark had to undertake, and then the insurance claim Clark filed with Travelers to cover those losses.
So all connected.
All of these shared factual circumstances tie the claims together. Furthermore, there were clearly common questions of fact, such as what actually caused the structural failure, what was the extent of the resulting damages, and who ultimately bears the responsibility for those damages. Common questions all around.
Okay, that makes perfect sense. So the court determined that Herrera was indeed a properly joined party under the rules. That brings us to the second crucial question. Could the court then simply use its power under Rule 21 to drop Herrera from the lawsuit in order to establish federal diversity jurisdiction over the remaining claim against Travelers?
This is where the court firmly said, not so fast. While Federal Rule Civil Procedure 21 does give courts the authority to dismiss parties from a case, the court in Clark made it abundantly clear that this rule is not intended to be used as a procedural loophole to manufacture federal jurisdiction where it doesn't rightfully exist under the statute governing diversity jurisdiction.
So they weren't going to allow Travelers to use a rule about adding or dropping parties to essentially sidestep the fundamental requirements for a case to be heard in federal court based on the party's citizenship. They saw through that.
Exactly. The court articulated several compelling reasons for its refusal to dismiss Herrera. One of the most significant concerns was the strong potential for duplicative litigation and the very real risk of inconsistent judicial verdicts.
Ah, that's a big one.
Huge. Imagine if Herrera were dismissed from the federal case. Clark would then be forced to litigate the exact same core factual issues. What caused the collapse? What were the damages in two separate court systems? In federal court against Travelers regarding the insurance policy, and in state court against Herrera for the faulty work itself.
Wow.
What if the federal court found one thing regarding causation and damages, and the state court found something completely different? That would create a legal quagmire and be incredibly unfair to Clark.
Absolutely. Talk about a recipe for inefficiency and potential injustice for the plaintiff. Just a mess.
And that directly leads us to the second major rationale. The principles of fairness and respecting the plaintiff's initial choice of forum. Clark originally chose to file their lawsuit in North Carolina State Court.
Their choice.
The court emphasized that allowing Travelers to remove a properly joined, non-diverse defendant simply to pave the way for federal jurisdiction would significantly undermine Clark's chosen forum and their overall litigation strategy. The court's opinion even uses phrases like fundamental fairness and expresses a clear concern about causing prejudice to Clark.
So the court was essentially saying, you, the defendant, don't get to unilaterally drag the plaintiff into a federal court just because you might perceive it as more advantageous, especially when doing so disrupts the plaintiff's legitimate strategic decisions about where to bring their case. Protect the plaintiff's choice, basically.
Precisely. And finally, the court also pointed to the important principle of judicial economy. Having two separate trials proceed in different court systems, both dealing with the exact same underlying set of facts and largely overlapping legal issues, would be a significant waste of judicial resources, the time and effort of the courts themselves.
Yeah, why do it twice?
It simply makes practical sense to have the entire dispute resolved in a single forum, especially since Herrera was properly part of the case from the outset.
So taking into account all of those really important considerations, the risk of having to fight the same battle twice, the inherent unfairness to the plaintiff in disrupting their chosen court, and the inefficient use of the judicial system, what was the ultimate decision handed down by the court?
Ultimately, the court sided with Clark and Herrera. They granted Clark and Herrera's motion to remand the entire case back to the North Carolina State Court where it was originally filed.
Back to state court it goes.
Yep. And as a direct consequence of this decision, Travelers' motion to dismiss Herrera in an attempt to create diversity jurisdiction became irrelevant and was therefore denied as what's called moot. The issue no longer needed to be decided.
And there was even a bit of an additional consequence for Travelers in this situation, wasn't there? A little sting.
Yes, the court even went a step further and ordered Travelers to pay Clark's attorney fees that were incurred as a direct result of having to fight the improper removal of the case to federal court.
Right, fees.
This serves as a clear signal from the court about the importance of adhering to the established rules governing federal jurisdiction and the potential consequences for attempting to circumvent them improperly. Don't mess around with jurisdiction lightly.
So for all the law students tuning in, what are the most critical takeaways from this John S. Clark case that you should really burn into your memory?
There are several key lessons here. First and foremost, remember that federal diversity jurisdiction demands strict compliance with the complete diversity rule. There are no exceptions or close enough scenarios. Everyone on the plaintiff's side must be from a different state than every single defendant, period.
Strict rule. Got it.
Second, while Federal Rule of Civil Procedure 21 provides a mechanism for dismissing parties, it cannot be improperly used as a shortcut or a loophole to try and manufacture federal jurisdiction when a non-diverse party was correctly joined in the first place under the permissive joinder rules of Rule 20A.
Right. It's not a procedural trick to escape state court if a non-diverse party is legitimately part of the case. Can't game the system that way.
Exactly. This case also powerfully illustrates that courts place a high value on fairness in the litigation process. They aim to prevent unnecessary and duplicative lawsuits, and they generally respect the plaintiff's initial choice of where they want to bring their legal action.
Fairness and plaintiff's choice matter.
They really do. Finally, John S. Clark underscores the critical importance of understanding how all of these seemingly technical procedural rules work together and how they can significantly influence a party's overall litigation strategy from the very beginning of a case. You have to think about this stuff up front.
So to bring it all together, the John S. Clark case really shines a light on the limitations of federal diversity jurisdiction and highlights the careful balancing that courts undertake when they're faced with questions about who can be sued together and when a party can be dismissed. It's not just about ticking legal boxes. There are very real practical implications concerning fairness and the efficient administration of justice at stake.
Absolutely. And it really prompts you to consider the strategic decisions lawyers must make right from the outset of a case. You know, when you're dealing with a situation involving multiple potential parties, where do you choose to file the lawsuit? What are the potential jurisdictional hurdles you might face? And what kinds of procedural maneuvers might the opposing counsel try to employ concerning jurisdiction?
Yeah, the strategic chess match.
It really encourages a deeper understanding of the strategic landscape of litigation. And you even have to think about potential ethical considerations in some of these jurisdictional battles, you know? Are you trying to remove just for tactical advantage or delay? Or is there a legitimate basis?
Definitely gives you a lot to think about. If you're continuing your deep dive into the world of civil procedure, this case serves as a really valuable illustration of how these seemingly abstract rules have very tangible and significant consequences in complex litigation scenarios. It's certainly worth revisiting to really solidify your understanding of federal jurisdiction.
Absolutely. And by examining how this case navigates the interplay between different procedural rules like Rule 20 and Rule 21 and the diversity statute, it truly encourages a more comprehensive understanding of the entire litigation process, extending beyond just the specific legal claims being asserted. It's how the pieces fit together.